We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
In this hour of the program, we'll be talking about new cars, something that we've done from time to time throughout the year, particularly around this time, because it is in April that for a number of years now, Consumer Reports has been putting out their car issue, in which they rate some of the best and worst of new cars. And it is now out on newsstands. Maybe you want to take a look at it. Maybe you're thinking about a vehicle, a new vehicle to you, whether that means something that is new or something that is pre-owned, and you're interested in what the folks at Consumer Reports think. You can go out there and you can get the magazine and you can look at things like their top picks in general categories. If what you're concerned is things like fuel economy or whether the car is fun to drive or how much it costs or how it brakes and handles or all that sorts of things in particular categories, you can see what they have to say. And we can take those kind of questions here this morning in this hour of the show. As we talk with Mike Quincy, he's an automotive specialist. He works at the Consumer Reports Auto Test Headquarters. That's at East Haddam, Connecticut. He's been with Consumer Reports for a number of years, does a lot of interviews, has been on this program before. And he's the guy who's responsible for making sure that all of the automotive data and information is up to date in the magazine, on consumerreports.org, and in their special publications. He edits the monthly automotive technical reports for Consumer Reports premium auto content. He also writes and edits content for the Consumer Reports car blog. So he has the opportunity to see and think about and rate a lot of cars. So if you have questions, give us a call, and I'm sure that he will do his best to help you out. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to write in, you can send us an email. Well, you can do that too. And the address is will-talk, just like it sounds, willtalk@illinois.edu. And Mr. Quincy, hello.
Hey, David, how are you today?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time. I'm sure there's a lot of things we could talk about here. We'll hopefully get some callers from people who are listening. But I guess when we do this, one of the things that I do, maybe the thing that I always to start out with is whoever it is I'm talking to, is say, well, you know, name for me a few of the best, the things that you think are the top picks for new cars.
Okay. Sure thing.
And you can, I don't know how, and I know that, of course, it goes in different categories, so it sort of depends on what size vehicle you want and how much money you want to spend and what's most important to you. But, you know, just name, are there some that you think pretty much are just all-around good choices?
Well, yeah, I think there's good choices considering the rising price of gas. I'll probably focus on those because we won't get to all of them, so I'll try to, you know, really hone in on the fuel efficiency.
Sure, and I think that's good because obviously that's a fuel efficiency. It seems that is more and more of a priority for people as they're thinking about what they want to drive.
Most definitely.
So what do you think?
Starting out looking at fuel efficiency, I mean, the Honda Fit is an awesome car for about $16,000. Consumer Reports test, we got about 30 miles per gallon, and that's, it's fuel efficient, it's reliable, it's actually fun to drive, especially if you get the manual transmission. And some of the best news about the Fit for this year is stability control is now standard. You used to have to buy the top-end model with a navigation system to get stability control, but now it's standard on all the models. So for a budget car, Consumer Reports is really big on the Honda Fit. Another model that gets great fuel efficiency and did well in our test is the redesigned Hyundai Elantra. And we're talking about 29 miles per gallon overall, a comfortable car, a nice cabin. And you get this without a turbocharger, without hybrids, but you've got a 6-speed automatic transmission, which is pretty unprecedented for this size car, and about $18,000. And it's a really good car at a very good price.
So how now? I'm curious because you talked about the fit and the fact that it was fun to drive, particularly if you have a manual transmission. And I think reading about the fact that it seems that as time goes along, there are fewer and fewer people who know how to drive a stick, and it seems like maybe there aren't that many people who want them. How you can still get a manual transmission in a car, and is that something that actually for a lot of models does continue to be a choice?
There's some people that are talking about the death of the manual transmission, and certainly the majority of buyers out there really want an automatic, and you can kind of understand, especially if they're driving in urban environments, a lot of stop and go. A lot of people would see, you know, putting the clutch in and out and creeping along in traffic is just too much hassle. Mm. However, in Consumer Reports testing, we find that you do usually get a slight fuel economy advantage with the manual. I mean, we went from 30 to 33 miles per gallon with the fit when we went up to the manual transmission. So you're definitely getting a fuel economy advantage. And one of the best things that actually I saw last week at the New York Auto Show was a number of models that were on the show floor with good old-fashioned manual transmissions, from Mustangs and Corvettes and Camaros to Audis and some BMWs. So the manual transmission is down, but it's definitely not dead yet.
Yeah, it's funny. Years ago, I had a friend who always used to say, a car with an automatic transmission, he says, that's not driving, that's just steering.
Right. a number of my colleagues and I really prefer manual transmissions. It gives you a little bit more control. It gives you a more engaging drive. But you can't knock. I mean, the best automatic transmissions are smooth. They're responsive. They're fuel efficient, especially the CVT transmissions that you can find in a number of Nissan products. They're less complex. They weigh less than an automatic transmission, and they deliver very good fuel economy.
Yeah, it seems that I would think that some people would say a couple of miles a gallon extra is significant, but maybe also people would say that the automatic transmissions that we have today are much better than they were in the past, and that has tended to close the gap somewhat in mileage between the automatic and the manual transmission.
Yeah, definitely. You're seeing a lot of efficiencies when you're going to the higher speed units, and as I mentioned before, with the Hyundai Elantra, a 6-speed automatic in an entry-level car is quite outstanding, and I think it helps the Elantra get the 29 miles per gallon overall that Consumer Reports measured.
Yeah, and having driven a number of cars with a stick, I do though think that there are cars, and I think my last car that I had a stick was a Passat, which I thought was a pretty good car, but I had this real strong feeling that and it had a 5-speed transmission, that it could have used a 6th gear. Is that in a manual transmission? Is that much of an option?
Usually you have to go into a sportier kind of car to get a 6-speed manual. Still, some of the more basic cars like the Fit and the Elantra, the Civic. I can't say unequivocally all the small cars don't have them, but most of them are still 5-speed manuals. Some of the sportier cars that we've tested recently, like the Ford Mustang GT, was a 6-speed manual. The last manual transmission Camaro was a 6-speed. And when you're going into a higher-end car, like a top-of-the-line Lexus, they have an 8-speed automatic. So we've gone from maybe like a 3-speed, or as they used to say, the 3 on the tree, to an 8-speed. So we're really progressing as far as transmissions go.
Well, and you're in the general category here, where you look at across all, you can pick a specific thing and look at one sort of thing, like mileage, for example. If that's what's most important to you, where you can look at just mileage. And then what you do is you try to collapse all the ratings across categories and come up with what you think is the best car, your best pick in a particular category. And I am struck that, in fact, in sporty car, it's the Mustang, it may be that's just not the kind of car we can have anymore, but somehow the idea of a V8 Mustang, you know, that still has some appeal to me. I'd imagine that probably it's quite a trip to drive a car like that.
Yeah, I think if you drive a Ford Mustang, especially the GT, and it doesn't put a smile on your face. There's just something wrong with you. I mean, it is such a ball of fire to drive, and you wouldn't think that back in the really lousy days of cars, like let's say the mid 1970s. I mean, imagine in the 1970s, you said, well, there will be a time when you can get a 400 horsepower Mustang GT and get 26 miles per gallon on the highway with it. I mean, imagine the odds that you'd get if you'd taken that bet back in 1974. And even the V6 model that Consumer Reports tested got 29 miles per gallon on the highway, which is just outstanding because the V6 still puts out over 300 horsepower. So even the V6 models of today really beat the tar out of the V8 models of decades ago. And it's the best Mustang they've ever made. It's comfortable. It has safety equipment. It has good reliability. And it's a top pick for Consumer Reports for a sporty car.
Well, is that difference in the performance, does it have to do with the weight of the car, or is it something about the engine?
I think they've gotten great efficiencies with engines. They've gotten direct injection, which is a more efficient way of feeding the engine fuel. You've got lighter weight components. They're using more aluminum and other lightweight materials. You have tires that have a lower rolling resistance. You have better aerodynamics. I mean, there's all kinds of efficiencies that automakers are finding with even their basic cars that are improving their overall fuel economy.
Okay. Our guest in this hour of focus is Mike Quincy. He's an automotive specialist with Consumer Reports. He works at their auto test headquarters in East Haddam, Connecticut, so he gets to drive a lot of cars. He also is responsible for making sure that all the data, all the automotive data and the information is up to date in the magazine, on the website, in their special publications. And they have just put out their new car issue of the magazine, and for a long time that's been April, the April issue of Consumer Reports, rates cars, and so if you're interested in what they think are the best and the worst in various categories, you can look at the magazine, and if you have questions, you give us a call. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. You can also go online and go to the website, or you can go online and send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's a caller, first up, Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Yes, thank you for the program this morning, gentlemen.
Sure.
I'd like to know whether you'd care to hop into the controversy of how green is my Prius. A big study by some, I suspect, automotively funded group comparing a Prius to a Hummer and life cycle costs and, you know, what is truly green. And so if you would specifically talk about that study, if you know anything about it, and then if you had to pick a vehicle with the lowest life cycle impact right now, what would it be? And I'll listen offline.
All right.
Thank you.
Well, that's a pretty loaded question. I've heard of the study comparing the environmental impact of a Hummer versus a Prius, and I think you have to look at it kind of with a grain of salt. I mean, the knock against the Prius and other cars that have huge battery packs is, what do you do with the batteries when they are used up? And they will be used up. You can only recharge batteries so many times. I don't think I have heard a reasonable explanation for what happens to them. So the answer is I don't know exactly. But I will say that from an environmental standpoint, the Prius is getting 44 miles per gallon overall in Consumer Reports tests. We consider this our top pick for a green car because it does so well with a gallon of gas. You'd be hard-pressed to get anywhere near that kind of fuel economy with a Hummer. And actually, the Hummer brand has been discontinued. So in some ways, the debate about Hummer versus Prius is over because they're not making Hummers anymore. But in terms of viability and impact on the environment, it depends on where you live. If you're living in an area where your source of electricity, for example, is clean, for example, out in California, you have solar electricity, you have electricity coming from dammed up water, you have wind electricity. If you can buy a Nissan Leaf, for example, which is an all-electric vehicle, and you can charge it up using clean electricity, then that is a good, you know, that's a good leg up for in terms of being an environmentally friendly vehicle. But again, you're back to the question of, what do you do with the Leaf batteries when they're used up? So it really depends where you live. And out here in Connecticut, we get most of our electricity from coal-fired plants, and we're in the process of testing the Nissan Leaf as well as the plug-in hybrid Chevrolet Volt. So we're using less gas on them, but again, we're using electricity from plants that spew various toxins into the air.
Okay. I hope that gets to the question of the caller. We have somebody else here who's ready to go, and this is someone who is in Pontiac on our toll-free line, line four.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm on my second Mini Cooper. I absolutely adore it. It is fun to drive. It gets about 33 miles per gallon. And I wondered if the magazine looked at those at all and if you have anything to say about them.
Oh, we love the Mini Cooper. We've tested the convertible. We've tested the base model. We've tested the Hot Rod S version. We've tested the Countryman, and we're actually in the process of testing the all-wheel drive four-all version, which is kind of pumped up. It's got a higher ground clearance and bigger rear doors. We're big fans of the Mini Cooper because, like you said, they're fun to drive. They're adorable, certainly, to look at. You can get that manual transmission. Look at that. So it raised its ugly head again. No.
Yep.
We love the manual transmission Mini Cooper because they are so much fun to drive. They've done well in Consumer Reports tests. Average reliability for the non-turbocharged versions. And one of the staff favorites for years.
Oh, good, good. Well, you know, I only have to get it serviced once a year. I have to drive up to the suburbs to do it. So I get a loaner, and I go and have lunch, and then I come back. And, I mean, it is just the best car.
And it has very high ratings in Consumer Reports owner satisfaction studies as well.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks very much.
Thanks. And that is, I know that I'm sure that there are people here in our area that would like to have a Mini, but for us here in Champaign-Urbana, unfortunately, there is no local Mini dealer.
Oh, that's too bad.
So
there's a business opportunity for somebody out there.
Maybe so. So indeed, as the caller said, if you live here and you have a Mini, you've got to drive up to the Chicago area if you want to take it to a Mini dealer to have them do the service. So I guess that may be an issue. Just let me ask you real quick, because as we said at the beginning, there are a lot of people now, for them, the bottom line is mileage, because they're concerned about the price of gasoline. And we've talked about cars and how they perform, and for example, if that's really important to you, you get a Prius, and overall you're going to get 44 miles per gallon. I think that's what you're reporting.
Yeah.
And you know, from time to time, though, you do read people writing things like, well, there's really no reason why you couldn't have a car that got 50, 60, 70 miles per gallon. What really are the limits of the technology, and why is it that we haven't managed to push it any more than we have?
I think one of the limits of technology is weight. For example, you need a car that can withstand certain side offset and frontal impacts, and with that comes a certain amount of structural integrity that you have to build into the car, not only the chassis, but the side impact beams as well. And I think you've also, at a point where, at least in the United States, where people generally like driving bigger cars. And when you combine the mass and the weight, that tends to bring down overall fuel economy. There were cars back in the early 1980s that were three-cylinder models. I think a Geo Metro was one of them. And they got fantastic fuel economy, but they were very noisy. They were not comfortable. And they didn't have all the creature comforts that we have grown to know and love. And that includes power windows, sunroof, high-end stereo systems, navigation systems, two-zone climate controls, all that stuff adds weight. I think weight is the biggest issue in terms of fuel economy, and I think we are getting there. I think we are making progress. However, I think if we had taken fuel economy really seriously during the first oil embargo, we would be farther along than we are today. But we had a few decades of relatively cheap gas, and America has shown that when gas is cheap, they like to go big.
Yeah. All right. We have several callers here waiting. Somebody who must be listening online. They're in Seattle, line one. Hello.
Hi. This kind of gets to the point you were just talking about. I feel like sometimes it seems like lower weights aren't leveraged enough. My favorite example is the smart car. I'm driving a Toyota Matrix. It's around 3,000 pounds. The smart car is, I don't know, 1,800 pounds, but they get about the same mileage. You know, Toyota's Matrix is rated 30 to 36. A smart car, just about the same. And I'm completely baffled by that. I feel like you would have to go out of your way to get a car that weighs that much less but has the same mileage. I'm not saying that's what's happening, but what is happening? How can that be the case? It seems to me if a car weighs half as much, although we're not talking quite half, it should get twice the mileage.
Yeah, you'd think. Yeah, we Consumer Reports tested the smart car, and we really didn't think much of it, to be honest with you. There were so many compromises that you had to make in terms of room, handling, comfort, noise suppression. The ride was harsh. The handling was clumsy. And even though it's you'd consider it a fuel efficient economy car, it required premium fuel. And for the money, you could get a decent Honda Fit, which is a lot more comfortable and gets just slightly less fuel economy. So,
well, I don't dispute any of that, but I'm baffled by the physics of it. That's what I'm asking. Mm-hmm. Asking, how is it even possible that that car gets such bad mileage in comparison with another car that's, you know, a third larger than it?
Yeah, I think you're looking at the efficiencies of the engine. The Smart uses a 1-liter three-cylinder engine, and while it is hauling less weight, the weight that it has to haul around can overmatch the engine. And you have kind of a laws of diminishing return when you put smaller engines in cars expecting to get better fuel economy, when in fact the smaller engines have to work twice as hard to move the mass. But listen, you bring up a good point and a good question. Why doesn't the smart car get better fuel economy? We tested a diesel version a number of years ago, and it got better fuel economy, but it was absolutely awful to drive. It was so slow.
All right, thanks.
All right, very good. And let me just very quickly introduce again our guest, Mike Quincy. He's an automotive specialist with Consumer Reports. He works at their auto test headquarters in East Haddam, Connecticut, and he's the guy who's responsible for making sure that all the data, automotive data and information is up to date for the magazine, for the website, Consumer Reports special publications. And we're talking about new cars, best and the worst. That's the subject of the April issue of Consumer Reports, and for a long time, that's been the big annual issue where they rate cars. And so if you're thinking about buying a vehicle, whether that's new, brand new, or just new to you, and you'd like to get some information on what the Consumer Reports folks think are good cars in a variety of categories and considering a variety of things, and mileage is one of them, you take a look at the magazine. And questions here are welcome. 333-9455, a toll-free 800-222-9455. Next caller we have in line is Belgium, line 2. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you, gentlemen. Mr. Inge always exhorts me to stay on the topic, and I hope I'm not going to stray too far from it with this question. I'm a cabinet maker, and I have found over the years that I like a small truck. It works best for me with a little trailer. And I had a Datsun that was a stick shift and a four-cylinder. It worked for years until the wheels just literally fell off of it. And in 2000, I bought a Ford Ranger, and I was talked into taking an automatic, which I have found I do not care for. And now I'm looking for a small pickup truck with a stick shift that would be able to pull a small load. And I'm finding I can't find it for Toyota. I can't find it with Ford. I can't find it with Chevy. Do you know of any place that makes a nice, fuel-efficient, small truck, pull a small trailer? I'm not talking about a fifth wheel or anything like that. I'm a small trailer that would make good gas mileage for me.
The best fuel economy we got from the smaller trucks came when Consumer Reports tested the Toyota Tacoma. Now, it's a good-sized truck. It's not a full-size truck, but the problem is that there really isn't – I don't think there's any manufacturer selling small – pickup trucks in the United States anymore. I think that between the Tacoma and the Ford Ranger, that's about as small as you're getting. There's some talk about an Indian manufacturer coming into the United States and selling a kind of a micro pickup or the kinds that you might see in Europe, which will certainly be a lot more fuel efficient. But right now you're kind of stuck with a Tacoma. You can get a manual transmission in a Tacoma. You can get a four-cylinder engine in a Tacoma. And I kind of chuckled to myself when you said you used to have a Datsun, because there's a few of us out there that remember the name Datsun. And for those that don't, Nissan is what once was Datsun. I wish I had better news for you, but I would look at a four-cylinder Tacoma.
Well, I spoke with the people at Toyota, and they said we can't get a four-cylinder stick.
Well, you know, they make them, but depending on where you live, Toyota is very regional in how they produce and distribute their vehicles, and somewhat aggravating because they will put on their website all these option combinations between engines and transmissions, but the truth is that they probably don't sell many, if any, in your area. That doesn't mean you can't order one. You can still go to them and say, listen, I know that Toyota makes four-cylinder manual transmission pickup trucks, and I want one, and I'll wait for it. But you'll have to give them a deposit and be serious about buying it. But trust me, at Consumer Reports, we test about 80 cars a year. We buy all the cars that we test. And we occasionally find Toyota's ordering process for cars absolutely aggravating.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks. So at one time, I know for sure that both Ford and Chevrolet and maybe some other makers were making little pickups. They were less than the full-size pickup truck. Then nobody does that anymore?
Not really. No, I mean, it just seemed like, you know, again, we talked about before, as gas came relatively cheap, people wanted things that were big. And even a Tacoma, which once was a small pickup truck, has now grown to be the size of what larger pickup trucks were a number of years ago.
And just for the benefit of those people who want a full-size truck, your recommendation is an American product. You think the Chevrolet is the best?
We really like the Chevrolet Avalanche. That's a top pick in Consumer Reports April issue. The Avalanche combines really excellent seating, comfortable interior, smooth V8 engine, flexible cargo carrying, decent reliability. Did very well in Consumer Reports tests, and for what it is, it's a very versatile and easy to live with vehicle.
All right, so we have some other callers. Urbana is next, line one. Hello.
Hi. I just want to give you my appreciation. Based on you guys' references, I bought an M35, and it has been a joy, and what a marvelous car.
Oh, love the M35. Fabulous sports sedan.
Yeah, it's been great. You guys recommended it highly, and based on that, it's been a pleasure. So thanks a lot.
All right, great. Well, who makes the M35?
That would be made by Infiniti. This is the premium version of Nissan, and the M35 is sporty, it's comfortable, it has good reliability, a fabulous V6 engine. We've loved the Infiniti M for a number of years.
If you wanted to have a sports car, a sporty car that is fun to drive, let's say it's a two-seater, so you want a classic sort of a little sports car, you want to get your stick shift, it wants to be fun and zippy, but you're not going to be able to afford a BMW or a Porsche, you know, something at the upper ends. Is there something that would answer to that description that would be within the price range of more people?
Oh, positively. The Mazda Miata is one of my number one choices for a small sporty car. You can get a manual transmission with it. The last one that we tested returned 28 miles per gallon overall. It has great steering, incredible handling, just a joy to drive. The Miata has been one of the best small sporty cars in decades, since it debuted, I believe, in 1989 or 90. Year in and year out, the Miata delivers lots of fun for the money and so easy to recommend the Miata.
All right. In this hour focus, we're talking about cars. Our guest is Mike Quincy from Consumer Reports. We have some callers we'll get right to and an email I'll take. In this hour, we're talking about new cars, and our guest is Mike Quincy. He works for does the automotive writing, I should say, for Consumer Reports, has worked for Consumer Reports for quite a while. He works at their auto test headquarters in East Haddam, Connecticut, and he's the guy who oversees the automotive data and information that's in the magazine Consumer Reports, online consumerreports.org. And if you're in the market for a new car, whether it is a literally new car or just new to you, you might want to take a look at their April issue of Consumer Reports, where they rate best and worst of the new cars for 2011. We have several callers here. If these people will be patient, let me ask you to talk about something here that an emailer has mailed in with and is interested in having you talk about the Volt, the Chevy Volt.
Okay, great. Love to. The Volt actually was the cover story of the April issue of Consumer Reports. It's a plug-in hybrid, and how that is different than the other the other electric car, the Nissan Leaf, is that the Volt has a gasoline engine attached to it, which acts as a generator when you basically run out of electric range. The plug-in part is literally that there's an outlet where you plug in a thick power cord and you charge up the Volt's batteries, and you hopefully get as many miles as you can, depending on like the weather. Because in Connecticut here, testing the Volt, we had a really harsh winter, and the cold temperatures, and whenever you're driving at highway speeds, it quickly drains your electric range. We were only getting around 25 miles on electric only, where the Volt was promising a lot more. Mm. As the weather has gotten warmer, our electric only range has improved, but there's still some compromises with that, because we found that it's not a great electric car because you're kind of limited in the range. It's not a great hybrid because the Toyota Prius gets a lot better fuel economy overall than the Volt when you're using the gas engine. And it's pretty expensive. It's about $43,000 before you get the tax subsidies that they're talking about. But for many people, electric cars are kind of the next progression when you went from small four-cylinder fuel economy cars to hybrids and now into these electrics. They have their strengths, but they still have their weaknesses.
Well, then tell us about the Leaf. Because this is an all-electric car?
The Leaf is the all-electric car, and actually I drove it last night, not necessarily because I was anticipating we were going to talk about it today, but it just kind of worked out that way. What is impressive about the Leaf is it's extremely quiet because there's no engine noise at all. There's barely any wind noise. You hear a little bit of tire noise coming through the cabin, but the acceleration is seamless. It just kind of put your foot on the pedal and it just kind of goes. I left the track with about a 90-mile range. That was a full charge. But even driving just a couple miles down the road, it was raining yesterday, and I had to put on the defroster, which means you have to kick on the climate system and use the AC. And it went from 90 to 84 in about a second. But as soon as I turned off the accessory, the range actually improved. I mean, every time you use an electric accessory on an electric car, for example, the lights, the radio, the climate control system, it will drain some of your battery power. But I have about a 13-mile drive from the track back to my home, and it handled it without a problem. I even got home and said to my wife, hey, you want to try driving an electric car? She's like, oh, that would be cool. And so she drove it around a little bit and showed some of the neighbors, and then I drove it back into work today and had no issues. But the difference between the Leaf and the Volt is when the Leaf runs out of juice, you just stop. You're dead in the water. When the Volt runs out of electric juice, the gas engine kicks on and generates more electricity. So your range anxiety, as they call it, will be a lot less with the Volt than the Leaf. But for me, if I was going to drive one car every day and a 26-mile round-trip commute, the Leaf would work pretty well.
Well, that is the problem there, that people who are interested in the possibility of an all-electric car, that's going to be the issue. So if that's the kind of driving that you do, if you're doing short trips, you're driving around town, or maybe you do have a commute that's in that kind of range, you're going 15, 20 miles, that'll work great. But if you have a longer commute, or you know, maybe you want to go visit your family and they live 150 miles away, that's just not going to work.
Yeah, in some ways, and I was talking to some of my colleagues about that, because some of us are into fitness and we're into eating healthily and we like organic food and we should eat more salmon and blah, blah, blah. And you're thinking about it, it's like, you know, to eat really healthy, it takes a fair amount of money to go to Whole Foods and to eat organic and things like that. If you want to be a green driving consumer, that also takes a fair amount of money, because, you know, the Leaf and the Volt are not cheap cars. You really, if you have a Nissan Leaf, you really have to have a backup car with a regular gasoline engine. You know, God forbid you have some emergency in the middle of the night and your car isn't fully charged up. You know, you're kind of in a tough spot. And as you mentioned, if you're going to be going on a road trip, you really can't count on on a, you know, a 90-mile range, getting you very far for your road trip.
Yeah.
So it costs a lot of money to be a green driver as well.
Well, and I'm sure that when it comes to battery design, the laws of chemistry and physics impose some kinds of limits. What does anybody think is the upper limits that you could get?
In terms of
the driving range, yeah.
Well, it depends on a lot of it depends on the weather. I mean, if it's really hot and you're running the air conditioning, you're not going to get as great a range. If it's really cold, the batteries don't hold their charge as long. If you're on the highway and doing highway speeds, your range drops incredibly quickly. So you really have to kind of plan out your trip, and if you can if you're driving to work, and let's say maybe you have a 40-mile a commute to work, maybe your employer will let you plug in your car while you're during the 8 hours that you're in your office, which will help you get home. But again, suppose you have a detour. Suppose there's a traffic diversion. I mean, there's a lot of things that go into it. I mean, we kind of take it for granted that when we have a gasoline-powered car, we can drive for miles and miles and miles. And the other thing, kind of from a practicality standpoint, it might take you, 4 to 12 hours to fully charge up your electric car. Now, when you take your regular gasoline car to the gas station, it takes you 5-7 minutes to fill up your tank, and you might get 400 miles out of it. So, I mean, there's a lot of different ways of looking at the electric cars, and I don't want anyone in your audience to think that we're bashing them. I mean, they've got their strengths, but they're not the silver bullet that I think everyone thinks they're going
to
be.
All right. We had several callers. We had a couple emails. We'll try to get them all in, and we'll get back to the phones here. The next person is in Clinton. The next person is in Urbana. How about that? Line 3. Hello.
Hi. I was hoping to go back to trucks and
sure.
Fuel efficiency. I spend a lot of time in Central America, and they have down there lines of diesel and turbo diesel trucks. Ford sells one. Toyota has one. Mitsubishi has one. I've heard of one by Isuzu that I've not actually seen. But these all make upwards of 25, upward to 30 miles a gallon. And I'm wondering what's separating the U.S. market from those things. This is an emissions issue, I think, maybe. But why can't that be fixed, and why can't we get those vehicles up here? They're terrific trucks. They're really good.
In terms of diesel engines, you're preaching to the choir. I love diesels. The diesels that Consumer Reports have tested have done very well. The Jetta diesel in particular is just a monster on the highway. It gets maybe 500, 600 miles with a tank of fuel. It's like driving from Connecticut to Detroit. It's amazing. But why the diesel engines have not taken hold in the United States, I really don't know the answer to that. I don't know. I'm not going to go so far as to say it's a conspiracy to keep diesels out of the country so we can sell more gasoline. That's that's a little crazy for me. But I just, for some reason, Americans have not embraced diesels. There's also issues of emissions. The diesels have to be cleaner these days, and the car companies have to kind of jump through hoops to get their diesel vehicles certified. But when you think about it, the infrastructure is there. The car companies build and sell these cars in other countries, and it seems logical to me that they should be federalized and certified to be sold in the United States. I think they'd sell a lot more of them than they think. And the fuel efficiency, as you mentioned, is incredible. And you'd get a lot of smaller vehicles that had good fuel economy with the diesel engines. In Europe, they're taxed differently. You have a lot more subsidies for diesel fuel than regular gasoline, and that's why you see a lot more diesels overseas. But I think the U.S. should definitely embrace more diesels.
8 miles a gallon, immediately added to your with the same capacity. I don't understand why we don't have it. Thank you much.
Right,
I agree. I agree 100%.
I'm sure that some people, part of the issue might be consumers who think of the tendencies of older diesels to be noisy and smelly, and I'm sure that people who design diesel engines would say, well, the engines we're building now are really much better on both those counts and generally on the emissions issue, but that maybe a lot of people think, well, they're thinking about what they used to be.
We're testing a Mercedes-Benz E-Class diesel, and it's so smooth and so quiet that you hardly even know it's running. You can barely tell it's a diesel even when you step outside of it. And the last one of the last diesel models we tested was the Volkswagen Touareg, which is kind of a medium-sized SUV. We were getting 24 miles per gallon overall. which isn't quite as good as the Toyota Highlander Hybrid at 27 miles per gallon overall. But again, that cruising range, the Touareg was producing 615 miles from a highway cruise. So you know, imagine filling up your Touareg diesel with diesel fuel, and you've got 600 miles to drive before you have to fill it up again. I mean, I really think that's incredible.
Okay. To Champaign, next, line one. Hello. Is there a caller there, line one in Champaign? Okay, let's go to Piatt County, line two. Hello.
Oh, hello. I have a Honda CR-V 2002, and it has been an incredible car for me. And then it turned over 200,000 miles. And so in the past year, I put over $4,000 into it. But I need a car that has that kind of carrying space in the back. And so, number one, when do you give up on a car? And then, number two, is there a recommendation for a car that's similar, that's as good as this car has been?
Sure. That's a fabulous question. And I'm glad you've had, you know, over 200,000 miles of good service from your CR-V, because that really supports the long-term reliability data that Consumer Reports has on the CR-V, which is excellent. I would say when you give up on an older car is when you feel that it might be a safety hazard. In other words, if you're driving home at night and you're afraid that you're not going to get home safely, if you think it's going to be breaking down, if you have doubts on relying on it starting early in the morning on a winter, you know, cold winter day, or when it becomes when the cost of repairing it is more than, like, say, the retail or wholesale value of it as a used car. If your used Honda CR-V is only worth $3,000 and you're putting $4,000 into it, then you're way over the top, and it's really time to consider another one. But if you're, you know, constantly getting it fixed, then it's just a headache. But if the money that you put into it is helping it run well, and you don't have lots of issues day to day or week to week or month to month, I'd say keep driving, because in the long run, driving your car basically into the ground is the cheapest way to stretch your automotive dollars. In terms of replacing, I would look at a Subaru Forester, a Toyota RAV4. Those are really the top two smaller SUVs with decent room, good performance, and good reliability.
Okay, thank you so much for your help.
All right, sure. Very good. Let me get into some questions here from our emailers. Someone would like you to talk about the life cycle of car battery packs, specifically used cars and replacement. So maybe they're thinking about buying a used hybrid car.
Sure. We've actually done some testing on some older hybrids. We've contacted people that, say, bought the early second-generation Toyota Prius. We had one gentleman bring us his Prius that had well over 100,000 miles on it, and actually we ran it through our tests, and it performed equally well as when it was brand new. The reliability data that we have on the hybrid battery packs are showing that they're holding up really well. We have over 10 years of reliability data on the hybrids that have been sold in the United States, and we see no reason to panic about the battery packs failing. That doesn't mean that they won't eventually, and that doesn't mean that you know, potential buyer of a used hybrid shouldn't get the car checked out, because you should always bring a used car to a trusted mechanic to look it over. But the reliability data, again, it shows that these are not the things you need to worry about as much as you would think with new technology.
All right. Here's someone who's interested in a recommendation. They're looking for a car for a larger family, 6 to 8 people, but they're also interested in fuel economy. What's your best recommendation for a vehicle that would comfortably seat that many people but gets good gas mileage?
Well, you know, the best bet for having, like, a vehicle with 3 rows of seats is a minivan. When we tested the Honda Odyssey and the Toyota Sienna, we were getting 19 and 20 miles per gallon overall, which is a lot better than most 3-row SUVs, except of course for the Toyota Highlander Hybrid, which does have 3 rows, but the third row in the Highlander is very, very tight. But again, you can't beat the Highlander's 27 miles per gallon overall. But in terms of fitting people comfortably, nothing beats a minivan, especially with the captain's chairs in the second row. The third row seats in the minivans generally will hold full-size adults fairly comfortably. So I would definitely look at the Odyssey and the Sienna.
All right. Back to the phones. And a caller, line one, Champaign. Hello.
Oh, hi.
Yeah.
So just talking about historic fuel efficiency of cars, you'd mentioned that in order to get, you know, in order to be decently green now, you have to spend a lot of money. But I had found, and I can't find it right now, but a website with reviews of cars, including fuel efficiency measures under a bunch of conditions, going back decades, just hundreds and hundreds of models. And so I looked to compare, you know, current, as in the last couple of year, fuel efficiencies with those from, say, 1999. And in, say, 99 and 2000, there were a bunch of models on the market, you know, ordinary gasoline-fueled cars that had fuel efficiencies in the high 30s and low 40s under sort of typical conditions, and their measure of typical was a little more conservative than the EPA measure. And today, there's essentially nothing like that. So, and of the models that were available just 10, 11 years ago, there were a couple of domestic ones. I think the Geo Metro, I don't remember mostly, but I think the Geo Metro was one of them. And then there were a handful of imported models of just kind of small, lightweight, efficient cars. And these have almost disappeared from the market.
It's a very good point, but you have to be careful making comparisons to cars that were 10 years older. The Chevrolet Metro that you're talking about, first of all, actually was imported, even though it had a Chevrolet badge on it. It came from Korea. But they had. I'm looking at the database right now for the 2000 Chevrolet Metro, and it had engine horsepower between 55 and 79 horsepower. Now, that is not much to get you up to speed on the highway. Now, while Consumer Reports is not necessarily advocating that we all drive high-horsepower muscle cars, you definitely need enough horsepower to merge safely on a freeway and to avoid accidents. One of the big differences between cars of 10 years ago and today is that today cars have standard anti-lock brakes, head protection airbags, stability control, traction control. They have much better crash test ratings. The Chevrolet Metro back in 2000 had none of those things. So you have to maybe make a compromise once in a while for a safer car, and you lose a few miles per gallon. And I'll also argue that today's smaller cars like the Honda Fit, the Nissan Versa, the Scion XD are more comfortable, they're quieter, they have more creature comforts. But you bring up a good point, because I wonder if there is a market out there in the United States that says, listen, I'll give up power windows and power door locks and a sunroof just to get better fuel economy. I don't need all that stuff. Make it small, make it light, make it cheap, and emphasize the MPG. I wonder, maybe there is a market for that.
I mean, there certainly used to be. And, you know, our parents drove around in, like, Volkswagen Beetles, which were uncomfortable, loud cars, but... And well, they probably weren't very efficient either.
They weren't very safe either.
Yeah. Well, no. But anyway, well, thank you then.
All right, thank you. Back here, we have a couple email questions to try to get them in. We have someone here who would like to know what you think about the Chevy Equinox.
The Equinox isn't bad. It's a smaller to mid-sized SUV. Did pretty well in Consumer Reports tests. I'm not going to say it was a groundbreaking SUV, but certainly a lot better than the model that it replaced. You can get it with a four-cylinder V6 model, a V6 engine. The V6 Equinox that Consumer Reports tested got 18 miles per gallon overall, which is fairly competitive for the midsize category. And again, it was much, much better than the model that it replaced. Is recommended by Consumer Reports because it has average reliability and did fairly well in our test. Now, again, not the top of the category, but certainly not the bottom either.
Okay, and we have someone here who has an extended warranty question. They say they have a new car. It offers 5 years of no payment for maintenance. They can extend this if they make an additional payment to the dealership. What do you think about extended warranties?
Generally speaking, Consumer Reports is not a big fan of extended warranties. I mean, you have to think that the auto companies or whatever company is offering this warranty has done the math. And it's like going to a casino. I mean, the odds are in the favor of the house. The odds are that you're going to pay them money and you're not going to be able to cash in on the warranty. I mean, that isn't to say that it will never happen. You might just happen to have something that will break on your car after the warranty expires and you have this extended warranty to kind of save your bacon. However, there you have to read all the fine print very carefully. They might say, we'll extend the warranty, but components A, B, and C are not covered. That's because they have enough data to go back and say those are the things that break after your car reaches a certain mileage threshold. Again, the odds are in their favor. They're not necessarily going to help you. I'm not trying to say they're all bad, but I think you have to be very careful about shelling out your money for this.
All right. Well, we're going to have to stop. I'm sorry to say we're here at the end of the time. For people who are listening, if you're going to buy a new car, you're thinking about being a new car buyer, or new or just new to you, one place you can go to get some information as you think about what you're going to do is to Consumer Reports. And if you look for the April issue of the magazine, this is the car rating issue. They've been doing that for a long time, tell you about what they think is the best and the worst of cars in a number of categories. Our guest this morning, Mike Quincy, is an automotive specialist with Consumer Reports. He works at their auto test headquarters in East Haddam, Connecticut. And Mike, once again, thanks very much for talking with us today.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me on. Love talking to you guys every time.
All right. Thanks.